played when they were a lot younger and that they learned from their parents and grandparents. And a lot of times they feel maybe it's gone out of style, but they don't want to get with some of the new music because they really like this music and they really appreciate when people like you turn out to hear them. Now I'd like to bring back on the stage two musicians who opened this section. Gordon Tanner, his son Phil Tanner. Gordon Tanner is a fiddler from Decatur, Georgia. That's about a half hour outside of Atlanta, but it's a country town. Gordon learned to play several instruments, but mainly the fiddle when he was a kid, and his father was a famous fiddler that made records back in the early days of country music, and his name was Gid Tanner. They had a band called Gid Tanner and his Skillet Lickers, and the last time they made records, they got their teenage son, Gordon, up to play the fiddle, and he made some records that are still loved today, some tunes that came out on those old 78 RPM records. And his son Phil plays the guitar, and he knows a lot of the old tunes too. And they'll play some of their music and tell you a little bit about it. It's a pleasure to introduce Gordon and Phil Tanner.
We'd like to do an old number that was recorded in the was mentioned a while ago in the group that was recorded back those at that time. So we have selected Flop-Eared Mule for this particular tune right here. Thank you. Thank you. We'd like to do one here that I've been hearing around 64 years. The title of this old number is Roll 'em on the Ground. Thank you. roll them on the ground. Shoot 7-Eleven, roll them all around. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, old tune called Be All Smiles Tonight. I'd like to do a little Hoplite Lady. Thank you, thank you. Oh yeah, we'll do a number here, the old Durand hornpipe, I believe it is. Thank you. Okay. We have another number or two here, and we have a request here to do Liberty. This is our version of Liberty. Thank you. All right, get there, Andy.
Would you like to close with Down Yonder? Have you done that?
Okay.
Tell them the story of how you came to be playing Down Yonder.
Well,
these
Art,
days.
This thing happened in a peculiar way, I guess. I was 17 years old, and the recording company had contacted my father for another recording of the Skillet Liquors. So the Skillet Liquors more or less had dropped two men, and that was a fiddler and also a banjo player. So my father, he said, son, we're taking you to San Antonio, Texas. And I says, well, I just assumed that I was going along to help do the driving. We was going to drive through, and my dad, of course, was the only one in the group that could drive with the blind man Riley Puckett and Ted Hawkins. So we made this tour and recorded, and of course we were there, and the session started while I was placed at the mic to do the lead, the Skillet Liquor lead fiddle. So we recorded Down Yonder and Flop-Eared Mule and Back Up and Push, and it was Ricketts Hornpipe, but I was playing the thing. They wanted a title to it, and they asked my father, says, what's the boy playing? What was that number to label it? He said, some kind of hornpipe. He said, well, we'll call it Tanner's Hornpipe. But I learned later that it was Ricketts Hornpipe. Yeah. So that is a sort of a quick sketch of the recordings that happened to happen.
Now, how many records did that sell?
Well, that's in the depression years there. A lot of these young people don't know what that word means, but that's when a dollar was worth more than a dollar. And you hardly got a dollar for a day's work, you might say. And that record sold well over a million in those depression years. And I suppose, and I'm sure it's still selling, in various groups from Lawrence Welsh on down. You know what I mean? It's no traditional tune there that we played. And I, as far as records is concerned, I reckon I was the only one, or we was the only one, made a full three-minute record of the old tune. Was no verse to it or nothing then. And of course, you hear a little verse added to it since then. Someone has added a verse.
Now, that says become one of the most famous of the fiddle tunes, but you're going to hear the man who fiddled on the original record of Down Yonder, Gordon Tanner.
Okay, let's hear it. Thank you.
You've been a great audience, and we have enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Okay, well, that's the end of this particular show. At 12:30, we'll have these musicians back, and we'll also feature the blues musicians that you heard a little bit earlier, Neil Patman and Jimmy Lee Harris. At 12:30, and then they'll be back again at 4. So if you'd like to know a little bit more about the traditions represented in this festival in some detail, there's some fine articles and pictures in the program that you can get for a dollar. So I recommend this program. Thank you very much. We'll see you later.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to talk to you this morning about traditional housing. My name is Bill Moore, and I live in Minnesota. But last July, the Department of Energy and the Smithsonian Institution asked me to go down to Georgia and talk to some folks who had lived in and built traditional Georgia housing. The kind of housing we wanted to look at, of course, was the dog trot house, which you see over to your left over here. And if you happen to have a festival program, it's on page 29 of that lovely program. With me on the stage this morning are several people I talked to, among the many I talked to last summer. Mr. Walter Brogdon, to my right here, is from Colquitt County, Georgia. Mr. Jesse Freeman is from Richland, Georgia, near Columbus. And to my left is Jack McGalliard from Pelham, Georgia, which is in Mitchell County, down south. And I'm going to be talking with them this morning, and I hope you'll listen and perhaps ask some questions of your own. We're concerned about several things: what a dog trot house is, how it functions, why it functions, and how the energy aspects, the heating and cooling of a dog trot house are particularly useful. I think we ought to wait for the helicopter. Walter Brogdon was born in and grew up in a traditional dog trot house, and I'm going to ask him to tell you just some of his reminiscences about this kind of house. Walter?
My great-grandfather, maternal grandfather, moved into that area in about 1860, and he built one of these houses out of logs, and that house still stands. The one I was born in, some 20 years after that, and it was built out of lumber and frame. And I lived in that house. I was born in it and lived in it until I was about 32 years old, and it burned. And I'm very familiar with what life was like in living in this style house. And it was fairly comfortable in the summertime. Not as comfortable as air conditioning is today, but I would just like to say that people can live, they can exist, fairly comfortable in this style house.
You know, people often think of old-time traditional housing or folk housing, as we sometimes call it, as always a log house. And one of the goals of our project here today in this house that's being built over here is to show you that while the form of the house is traditional, the materials can vary as time goes by, because people keep the plan of the house, the sense of space, in their heads, and then use whatever is at hand. Do you remember the differences between the log house, which is in your family, the old log house, and the frame house? They were both dog trots, as I remember. And were they significantly different? Was one better than the other, or more beautiful in your mind? Or?
I guess the frame type house was a little more modern in the time it was built, but far as convenience, I can't see where it was any more convenient than the old log dog trot house.
Was it any cooler in the summer, or was the log house cooler?
I never did live in the log house. Now, I have slept in the log house a few times, and as far as temperature and staying cooler, I can't see any significant difference in that part of it.
Did they both have wooden shingle roofs?
Yes, originally when each one of them was built, the shingles were split with a tool that they call a froe, because it wasn't in the shingle mills, wasn't even in sawmills when the first log houses were built in the area. And they would take a log that saw it up into blocks, it would split easily, and use that tool froe and split those shingles out of it, and that's what the roof was made out of.
The old log house that Walter lived in is a beautiful example of folk craftsmanship. The carpenter work on the roof support system, the porch railings is just marvelous. I wish I had all the pictures here to show and share with you. You had a kitchen attached to the, was it to the back of your houses?
The kitchen was usually to the back of the house. Now the house that I was born in was a frame house, and the kitchen was to the back, and another road was built to the end of the old house, and that old kitchen was torn off and a newer part put on there, and it was built facing the newer road that was put through there.
So it's traditional for these houses to be built facing the road, that the front of the house always facing the road to present yourself to people coming to see you. And does that make any difference about the breezeway? The breezeway, as you know, the hallway or the dog trot, is the most efficient part of cooling this house. So does it matter how that house is oriented to north or south, or does it always work?
They seem like the early settlers had a preference to give those houses an eastern exposure if possible, but if it wasn't possible, you could have another exposure. But an eastern or a southern exposure was certainly preferable, because people sit on the porch in the afternoon. They didn't want it to be on the west where the sun would come in and hit them. And of course, the breeze, as far as the wind, of course, the wind shifts and comes from various directions, and what breeze there is, but it'll usually find that breezeway and to help cool that house, no matter which direction it's coming from.
We're talking to people from South Central Georgia this morning and talking about traditional or folk housing, and we're focusing on the dog trot house and the experiences of these people living in or having built this type of house. I'm going to ask the man to my left now, Jack McGalliard from Mitchell County, Georgia, to just tell us something about what life is like for him in a dog trot house. He lived in an area just east of Pelham, Georgia, as I remember, in a house a little bit bigger than this, but maybe he'd like to tell you more about it. What was the difference, Jack, between this house that we're building and the one that you lived in?
Bill, the house that I lived in was a bigger house. Well, now, you can't judge the size of this house here by the ones that we lived in, because the rooms were a lot bigger, and they usually had two beds in each room, in the bedroom, and the kitchen was also the dining area. The dining table was in the kitchen all combined, like a lot of the rooms are now. You have your dining room and kitchen together a lot of places now, on your modern home. And as far as the house, a lot of people seem to think it might be real cold in the wintertime, but it wasn't. Most of the houses had about three fireplaces. The reason I can remember that so well is because I had to get in the wood for all three of the fireplaces myself. And they didn't seem to have any mercy on me when they started burning it either.
But, as I remember, Jack, outside the front room window on one of the gable ends, there was always a kind of a wood shelf, wasn't there?
That was what they call a wood rack. We had to put wood on that rack by the main fireplace, and that was for... You reach out the window and get you a piece of wood in off of the shelf out there. Now they have wood boxes inside the house where they have their wood, which is in the modern homes. I don't know, they still look bad in there. But all of our wood was outside. You could reach out through the shutter window and pull the wood into the fireplace.
I imagine it's a little bit cleaner to keep the wood outside than to stack it inside.
I would think so, yeah, because you have different things on your wood, splinters and termites. Flatheads and things are in the wood.
One of the awful things about the stereotype of folk housing is that people thought it was real primitive and real dirty and sloppy. And it was anything but. It was prim and neat, and people were real careful about the way they kept the interiors of their house. Do you remember the way that your mother and dad kept the inside clean and what they used? Did they use sponge mops or
no, Bill? They used shuck mops. to scrub the floors with. Then, well, let's start back at the sweeping the floors. Each day they'd be swept with what they call a broom straw broom. Broom straw, you have to go out in the field and wring it and bring it in and let it season more or less and then clean it. That was after the frost fell on it each year. You clean your broom and the straw, then you make your broom dry, which would be about, be no handle in them at all. It'd be all the broom straw, be about 3 feet long, and the lady would use that to sweep her house with. Then you would take a piece of, say about a 2x10 or 2x12, and you make your shook mop out of that. That's what they use to scrub the floor with, using Red Devil Lye or homemade potash soap to clean the floor with, which would be real clean and eventually turn white almost, where they'd be clean so good.
I've seen some traditional houses which had fireplaces that were either covered, the fronts were covered with plaster or with clay, sometimes white clay they'd get out of the branch and put up there to make it look white and clean.
It'd be a certain type of clay they could put on the front, Bill, but all it wouldn't stand the heat, they'd crack up and fall off pretty well.
You'd have to replace it. Sometimes folks call that the courting room. Wherever the courting room is, a gentleman comes in to see your daughter, you want to make sure that fireplace looks nice and clean and neat and proper.
That was a sitting room.
Sitting room, right. How about the yard? I've heard the mention of the swept yard, which has perhaps African origins, perhaps has Indian origins, we don't know. But in Georgia today, people still keep a swept yard. What is that, Jack?
They don't, as many of them keep a swept yard now, Bill, as they did back in the days we were talking about. There was no grass in the yard whatsoever. The yard would be swept with what we call a gallberry yard broom. We'd go down in the woods and cut us some bushes and bring them back to the house and beat them on the fence that all the leaves are off, and we use this broom to sweep the yards with. And the yard would begin to wear a little bit down to the red clay. You go off to the river somewhere, a sand pit or something, and haul sand in where it'd be real white in the yard. Anytime there's any grass started growing in the yard, you had to get your hoe and start getting it out.
Was that an adult's chore, or was that for children to do?
In my case, it was for the children.
Anyone visiting South Central Georgia today will have the pleasure of seeing, perhaps in the space of a day or two, you could probably see 20 or 30 of this type of house built either of logs or of frame construction, still being used today, many of them. Some are abandoned. And when such houses are left empty for a long time, they, of course, begin to deteriorate. One of the wonderful things that we have in this country is the Outdoor Museum or Folk Museum, which has the responsibility and the privilege of sometimes acquiring these old houses, restoring them, sometimes moving them to the museum site, and opening them to the public. It's like the Smithsonian Folklife Festival all year round, only developing along regional lines with, say, Georgia, South Central Georgia culture. Jesse Freeman here lives near Columbus, Georgia, and has worked at an outdoor museum called Old Westville near Lumpkin. And at Westville, he was instrumental in helping restore houses there of this type. Jesse, what kind of work did you do there at Westville?
Well, we restored most of about 33 projects, old houses, cotton gins, boot shops, doctor's office, different counties, about 7 counties in South Georgia. We had to take them down, dismount them, and restore them on the site.
Now, when you take, you say you take a house down, you take it all apart, do you?
That's right, down by piece by piece.
And how do you keep track of those pieces?
Well, we had to mark them up, take a drawing of them, and some of them would be rotten. Well, you had to go replace them, when you put it back.
And then you'd move the whole structure to the museum site and then reconstruct it?
Reconstruction. And most of them, would be rotted out or something, No huge pieces of timber. Some of them, and we have had pieces of timber something like 52 foot long and about 12 by 12.
Can you still find a 12 by 12, 52 foot long pine log today?
Yeah. There ain't no more. Well, not down in South Georgia.
So when you replace it, you have to use sections, I suppose.
Right. Yeah. Well, most of the time you would run up on a tree, but you wouldn't find it that long. Yeah.
Do you sometimes take parts from one old house and use it to repair another one?
That's right.
Kind of like a butcher job.
Well, most of that's where you would find it, out of another old house, maybe an old barn or something like that. You just couldn't go out to the sawmill and get it.
Well, one of the things you have to be very careful about reconstructing when you move a house is its fireplace, because that was the source of heat and sometimes almost the mark of the house itself. And Jesse has been working on the fireplace for this house. He has some real specific ideas about what makes a good fireplace. What's the best way to make sure you're going to get warm from a fireplace when you build one?
Well, the best way to construct a fireplace, we construct them out of bricks, and most of the old that we replace in Westville, we construct them out of rock, plain rock to get out of the field, you know, build a chimney out of. But the most important thing about it, to try to get it up as well as you could, be sure that your fireplace is, you know, would draw well, not smoke, it would draw well, and it was very particular about building the firebox in it. You had to know what you was constructing.
I think you mentioned to me yesterday that the firebox has to have a back that slopes.
Well, it would have a belly in it, what they would call a belly, you know. That belly would be for to, if your blade come up and make a roll, and then your air would come down the chimney and turn that blade to make it pull away, make sure it wouldn't smoke.
So that's kind of a slanting surface that comes out towards the person who sits in front of the fireplace.
That's right. It come out and go back right at the fire shell.
Yeah, a fireplace is not just an open space. It's a carefully proportioned space, carefully designed over generations. And Jesse is one of those few people who has mastered that proportion and can reconstruct it for traditional housing. We're talking about dog trot houses in South Central Georgia, and I'm talking with people who have lived in them or who build them. And our dog trot, of course, is over here, somewhat reduced in size, but just about the same general proportion as a real dog trot house. One of the things we might think about, since this whole project is sponsored by the Department of Energy in part, is how could we adapt ourselves to this type of house today? If you were to build one today, you'd certainly be thinking about hot weather, because as we've discussed, it's very, very functional for hot weather. The grounds, the house sits about 18 to 20 inches off the ground. It has a breezeway down the middle, which is open, and a loft area, which tends to insulate the surface of the roof from the rooms within. Would any of you like to think of ways that we could take modern technology and improve upon that dog trot house for winter use? Would you, Jack, would you make any changes in dog trot houses for winter use today?
No, Bill, if I had...
No fair using the air conditioner now, that's not fair.
If I had an opportunity to build a house like this, which someday you can't ever tell, you might have to go back to them, I wouldn't make any change. The only change I would make now in the house is maybe insulate it a little more between the walls. As far as the design, I think it was laid out pretty well. It was almost like a trailer being built today. Every space was used. There wasn't any wasted space in the house at all, except maybe the hall. It was open, but that was for a purpose. There's always a breeze through there. And when I was a young boy, come in from the field on a hot day, I'd always lay down in this hall and get a nap, which I always take cool, get a little sleep.
Well, the name dog trot must have come from someplace. Where do you suppose that term came from? What's your opinion about that?
My opinion of that is, Bill, that back in the days we're talking about now, when I was a young boy, I had a bulldog. In fact, almost every family did had a special type bulldog. And this bulldog would always try to find the coolest place in the house to lay down, and it would be in this hallway, which he was never allowed inside the other room, living rooms anyway. He'd stay in that hall. That was in the daytime when it was warm and when you was awake. But my opinion is, when you was asleep, that he would be walking around and trotting down through the hall, looking after things while you were sleeping. He was your protection. That's what he was there for. And that's you could wake up at night and you could hear him pitter-pattering down through that hall. In my opinion, that's where it got his name, Dog Trot, from.
I see. One of the things you're looking at here is a complex of buildings which are actually related. You have the dog trot house here. You have a smokehouse behind you, which in any traditional farm complex would be there for the preservation of meat. And then you have the canning tents off to over your left shoulder, and that would somehow be related to the house or to the smokehouse sometimes to integrate the food preservation and consumption for the family. I want to ask Walter Brogdon here from near Omega, Georgia, what his boyhood house was like. Did you have these outbuildings? What kind of outbuildings did you have in your?
Well, usually park? the bathroom, we call them Johnnies. They were built out behind the house, usually 50 to 75 yards from the house. And We had no indoor toilet facilities, and of course the barn was already out there where the work stock, the horses or mules, which we had for energy to make the crops, were out there, and the smokehouse was always in the backyard where the hogs were butchered and cut up, and it was cured, salt cured, and then it was hanged up in the smokehouse, and the smoke with oak wood or hickory wood or something would smoke that meat to give it the flavor. And that's usually the buildings that were around the house when I came into the world.
Jesse Freeman, to my far right here, has worked in restoring these old buildings in a museum setting. And I want to ask him the same question. When you put an old house like a dog trot or whatever into a museum, do you have room to put up all the outbuildings that should be there, the Johnnies, the privies? And the
well, we mostly didn't put up the outbuildings. You know, we had a modern type shelter in the village, you know, for tourists and different things like
I
that.
See. But how about smokehouses? Were you able to put those
We used a smokehouse. We got the old original smokehouse. We smoked meat, every vessel, you know, and make kangaroo. Most everything the old people did back in the olden days.
Jesse's work at Westville in Lumpkin, Georgia is really significant because that's a museum that not only presents the artifact, the building, but also the process of people living in or using those buildings and the process.
That's right. We never constructed anything above 1850. We constructed back from 1850 back, you know. Anything was above 1850, it was too new.
I'd like to ask our people in the audience, your listeners, what you'd like to say about this house. Do you have questions about its energy efficiency or about its form or anything whatsoever? This panel of experts is here at your service. And there must be one question out there. The question is the breezeway used in any way for storage space, like a utility area or a washing machine? How about that, Jack? Remember that from your time?
Sometimes, Bill, they would put maybe what they call, you see these antique shops now, that's what they call a little wash stand or a hat rack, something maybe hanging in the hall, but not too much. It was usually left pretty well open. Yep. Now, he's talking about a washing machine. This is way before the washing machine come into effect. You wash your clothes out in the yard on a wash pot, boil them in a pot, and scrub them out on the old rub board.
Yeah, one of the things that a Yankee like myself discovers about Southern culture is that there's some very specific places for some very specific things in this type of traditional housing. And one thing is the wash shelf, which is always, I guess, on the back porch, isn't it? And that's where you have your basin, your soap, and the menfolk come in from the field, they wash up, and then go on in. Women were very particular about tracking up the house. That's another reason for staying out in the breezeway. Jesse, you wanted to say something about this breezeway.
He was talking about a washing machine, but most of the time they had the wash tub in the rub boat, and you wash the clothes down at the spring. He's out to the well.
I wonder if any of these young people out here know what a rub board is. It's there's a young person who knows.
She's not a young lady.
Any other questions out there that you'd like to ask about the dog trot house?
Bill, I've seen a rub board here somewhere in some of these buildings. I don't know where it is right offhand, but I've seen it someplace around here.
Well, if there is any art, that's an art of using that thing. Mr. Lane. Yes. What's the rub board made out of?
Wood.
Traditionally, it's a board about 3 feet long, 2 feet long, maybe about a foot wide.
Most of them you find nowadays, they got something made out of metal, but back in the old days, you had to go get your wood and make your own.
And it had ribs in it.
Eugene, you're pulling our leg now.
People even use rub boards for playing in bands today and, you know, so forth. Washboards, sometimes they call them washboards where I was from.
Also, ladies, these had a bedding block, too. They would take the overalls or the work clothes and take them out of the wash pot. They'd put them on this battening block and they'd hit them with this stick called a battening stick. That was supposed to be loosening the dirt up where you got tired. It takes it out now. Loosen the dirt up, and then you rinse it through about 3 wash waters and rinse all the blue dye out of your overalls. And another bad thing about it, these women would hit the hooks on your galluses, your overalls, and bend them all up, and you had trouble with them, too.
We had a question just a moment ago about what that space might be used for, that breezeway or hallway. And seems to me we talked about quilting there, didn't we, the other day?
They might did it in the summertime some, but most time they have the quilting frames in one of those big rooms.
Quilting frames were suspended from the ceiling in a big room, and sometimes you can walk in these houses today and the hooks are still there, and they simply raise that frame up out of the way when they weren't using it and bring it down when they wanted to quilt. There was a question back here, yes. Where does the name Dog Trot come from? I've already asked Jack McGallier that question. Are there any other definitions for the origin of the Dog Trot?
I don't have any, Jim.
You don't have any? Jesse, do you have an origin?
Well, like he said, most of the time, that's what a dog trotted. He always trotted but through that hall and right up to the kitchen.
To the kitchen.
Yeah, you visit a traditional farmhouse today, and you'll find one or two, at least two dogs up there on the breezeway. They know where the coolest place is. And that's where they hide out. You can also you see both ways. Your breezeway being open, you can see both directions, front and back, and you can catch sight of your stock, your cattle, and you can also see visitors coming up the front way. It's a good vantage point. It has lots of good functions.
One of the dog's jobs was to keep the cattle and hogs from out of the yard too. That he could see both ends of the house and he'd know which way to go.
Well, I would like to add, I heard Jack say that he would lie down in the middle of the day because it was the coolest place to cool when he came in from work. Now, I can remember it'd be some nights when a heat wave would come through. It would be uncomfortable in the room when I went to bed. I'd just get me a quilt and a pillar and get out in that breezeway and lie down and go to sleep and wake up the next morning.
Well, that's what they were for.
We had that happen in my neighborhood one time. The man went out there and sleep. He forgot to put his pajamas on, just in his underwear. The next morning he woke up, the school bus was sitting at the front door.
Ma'am, you had a question. The question is, does the breezeway always run north or south or east or west, or is there any particular orientation to the compass? Jesse, well, wow, but you've seen a lot of these houses. You've surveyed them.
Most of them you will see the breezeway setting east and west.
East and west for your area, yeah.
Yeah.
The idea is to pick up the prevailing breeze if possible, but at the same time, Walter, you said that as much as possible they try to get the front of the house face the road because they want to present themselves, of course, to the road directly. It's so uneasy to build your house at an angle to the road. Most of us almost would never think of that, although it's perfectly possible. Just turn the foundation around. You know. Are there other questions? Well, if not, I think we'll turn to some traditional music. I think they'll be starting off here in about 5 minutes off to your left. I thank you very much. I thank our participants, and we'll see you again later on this afternoon.